This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello and welcome to the third installment of the Pro Wrestling Love series, covering the top 25 TNA Impact Wrestling matches of all time. We will be covering numbers 15 through 11 on this episode. I am joined by Pro Wrestling Only's LP, a.k.a. Jerome. I am Marty Sleaze, a.k.a. Superstar Sleaze, on the PWO forums. And we're looking forward to getting into number 15 and 11 and hope you guys enjoy this podcast. Thank you. All right, so moving on to my number 15. Hold on, sorry. It is the TNA Knockouts Champion Gail Kim versus Awesome Kong from Turning Point 2007.
Oh, from Turning Point.
Yes.
Okay, so I don't have it.
Don't have it. Did you? No. Do you have the final resolution match?
Of course.
Of course. Okay. So I think they're very similar. I like both of them. I just like this one. I like this one a little bit more, I think, because of the finish. There's something about
really?
The other finish. Yeah, you have to remind me what the other
non-finish.
This one was the non-finish, but the other one I felt like there was like a it was an odd finish to the other one. But anyways, let me talk about this one, then we can talk about yours later. So this is their first pay-per-view match together. Gail Kim had just won the Knockouts title. She was the inaugural champion. Awesome Kong, in my opinion, is like the closest thing we've had to Vader, not just like in the women's division, but like just overall in general. She's a total freight train, and she's just so good at just being a monster and a bully. Gail Kim, we've talked about it earlier in the podcast, our previous episodes. Gail Kim is just a bumping freak. She's so good at it. Sells really well. But the key is she never dies. She's always peppered in those hope spots. She never sells too much. She keeps coming back for more, and she's so scrappy. So I think that's a real lost art in recent years is a lot of people just sort of flick a switch. It's either they don't sell at all or they're 100% like Ricky Morton dying selling. And it's like there's like an in-between to it all. And so I think Gail Kim really hit the perfect note in this and what was always moving forward. Awesome Kong was just that mountain she needed to scale, just charging, you know. Oh, the other thing that I thought was really interesting is the way they set up Gail Kim's offense. A lot of it was based on Kong charging and missing the spot. And so this she basically hurt herself, and that allowed Gail Kim to get the opportunity to fight back. So I really liked how they set that up. You know, there was a really nice spot where Gail Kim uses repeated missile drop kicks, and Awesome Kong does this whole Crusher Blackwell Weeble Wobble sell to really build to that final drop kick that's going to bump her off her feet. That hits, and boom, the crowd just erupts. So I think stuff like that, not bumping too early, you know, building to the big bump is so crucial, and is also a lost art. So we get the Kong makes her comeback, spinning back fist, and as we pointed out, this is when she snaps, pie faces the ref, triggers the DQ. I just loved how this was the first match in the series. It just like hit all the right notes for me, and I understand why some people wouldn't like it because the non-finish, but just like it was such a great first match in the series, and so yeah, that's why it's kind of at 15 instead of being a little bit higher, because I think if you do have a finish on this, I think this could be top 10.
Oh yeah, the only reason why I didn't have it on my list is because there is no finish. So to me, it keeps there is a finish, but it's a shit finish. So to me, it's like it's building to the next match. But yeah, I agree with pretty much everything you said. I mean, about Osokum, basically she was almost. Even you could argue she was even better than Vader at being a monster because she did less and she was bumping less a little bit. She was yep. she because Vader would have bumped the first time on the dropkick. You know that pretty much.
I agree with you, Vader. Yeah,
but I love Vader. I mean, I love Vader. That's not, to me, it's not a critique. Also, I can see why some people don't like that. But to be a monster, yes, she was awesome at doing like the hit me one time, two time, I'm gonna fall, and then she feeds. But basically, the women's revolution begins right there, if we're honest.
Yep, I agree with you 100%.
It's the first big match for US women's wrestler on pay-per-view ever, I guess. There were Bull Nakano in the 90s, but it was just a spot here and there. But basically, this is the beginning of what we're witnessing right now, basically. So he had almost 10 years before WWE. And it's really unfair that these two are not going to be celebrated as they should, because there are two. That means it's like the perfect match. So Gail Kim was, like you said, the bumping freak. Everything she did was great. Everything she did looked great. I mean, the bumps looked great. The selling looked great. The offense, I mean, because she was not so small, but compared to Awesome Kong, she was. But still, every offensive move she did on Kong was great. Kong was great at selling for Gail Kim whenever she had to, even though she didn't sell a whole lot in this match, because it was building to the next one. Awesome Kong, yeah, Vader, or Aja, I mean, the most obvious influence is Aja Kong, and even the name comes from there, because she was training in Japan. And it was like the perfect match, for the perfect bumping, selling babyface against the perfect big bully monster. She had also, what was great about the Awesome Kong in this match and in general, the work was great, but the interior presentation was great with Awesome Kong. Her demeanor, that's impossible to pronounce for me.
Her attitude
was great. Even the second she walked down the rampway, the way she looked at the people, the way she walked, and during the match, same thing. Very small details, the way she looked at the referee, or the way she looked at Gail Kim, the way she moved around when she wasn't doing big spots. And to me, that's pretty rare as far as being like a top-notch monster worker, but she totally had it. So, you really, when she looks at Gail, you really think she's going to kill that bitch. It's crazy. So, and not only she has that, but when she does the spot, it looks great. Everything she does looks great. And at the end, doesn't she kill the referee too?
Yeah, she
probably takes the ref. She takes the referee, she powerbombs the ref, yep. I think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she powerbombs the ref. And I think I don't think they're the beautiful people yet, but the beautiful people come out and she destroys them too.
Yeah,
you bring up a good point. I mean, Awesome Kong is probably one of TNA's few success stories.
Yeah. And she went down to, I mean, I don't know what happened in WWE for her, but to one, it didn't work out. And then she was great in Glow. Have you seen Glow?
No, I haven't. Was she really interested in it? I didn't know that.
You didn't know that she was in Glow?
No, I wasn't aware. No, I'll have to watch it just for that.
Oh, wow, she's awesome. She's great. The first two seasons are really pro wrestling heavy. The third one a little bit less, obviously, because the story keeps on going, but I mean, it's just a great show. And Tia Stevens, which is her real name, she's terrific in this. So I hope she's going to get more role, because she probably her in-ring career is going to be she's pretty much over now. She's really banged up. But no, she's awesome. So yeah, she was a great worker, great monster. Like you said, there are not a lot of great monsters like that even today. And perfect match. It would have been on my list if there was like a satisfying finish, but I understand why they were doing that. And it was at the time, it was the hottest program on TNA.
Oh, but yeah,
It was revolutionary, and they were outworking the guys at the time. It's late 2007. Their match and the physicality of their match, I mean, That was brutal, really. It didn't look like some choreographed brawl or anything. It looked like Song Kong was killing that poor girl. And like right. You said, one thing I totally agree is that Gail Kim, she wasn't selling like I'm dead. Please cry for me. She saw, but she was always pushing back. And at the end, the accumulative effect was that she was making a comeback. But she was basically always trying to make a comeback.
Yep. I think that's really the key. Like you said, it doesn't feel choreographed because she's constantly fighting back. So there's not that level of cooperation.
And the spots, there are two awesome workers. And the perfect match. So, and they were drawing the biggest ratings on TV. So it could have been... the beginning of something big, but of course, a few months later, Vince Russo comes back and the women's division goes to hell, which is the story of TNA, basically.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah, so Vince, see, the thing is that I get so confused about the timeline because Russo's in and out a lot, so yeah. I don't know when he's in and when he's out, but yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
I don't remember exactly, but I do remember that there is, or maybe it's not Russo, it's out, but the people, because at some point Dutch Mantelis gets fired, then Corny gets fired, and one Russo is alone. So maybe he was back already. I'm not too sure, but there is a clear point where you can see the women's division going to hell.
I see. Okay. Yeah. That does make a lot of sense. That's
yeah.
true.
And it's so sad because it didn't really bounce back until I think much later, because then there were an influx of better talent like Mickie James when she came. And the Beautiful People were not great workers. They were a great act at first.
But yes, they were a good act at first. I remember them fondly from when I would watch regularly. They were a good act.
Especially when they are the only one like that.
Yes.
When they're slutty, very as heels, especially. When they turned babyface, it didn't work out to me. But they're a really great act. And it took years, I think. But I think Awesome Kong came back also later, much later, but I haven't seen that. In the 2010s.
Maybe. Yeah. Actually, yeah, I think she did. I randomly watched some pay-per-views from 2014 or 15, and I would skip around in the pay-per-view, and I did see her go up against Taryn Terrell and stuff. So yeah, she did come back, yeah. She was even in AEW for a hot second. I was
I love that. When I saw her, I was like, yes!
I know, I was pretty
sure. That's
probably
cool,
what I was most excited about, yeah.
Yeah, and she went home. She was supposed to shoot the new season of Glow, and the show has been canceled because of COVID, so that sucks.
Oh, I see. I mean, not to get too AEW, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too much, but it's very clear to me AEW wants Nyla Rose to be Awesome Kong, but she's just not there.
No, she's not, but she's still really good.
She's really good, but there's just Awesome Kong is just at that next sort of level type thing.
Yeah, that's the issue. It's not that Nyla Rose is not good. I mean, I really love her, but Awesome Kong, she was just that. I mean, she was awesome. She was a great worker. And before, yes, we should give these two a lot of credit that they are not getting because TNA.
Yeah, because of TNA and its toxicity. Yeah. So what was your number 15?
Again, likewise, it's a case of what could have been and the insanity that what TNA had and it never went anywhere. So it's from 2010. It's Bound for Glory. It's the Motor City Machine Guns versus Generation Me, a.k.a. the Young Bucks.
Oh, I have seen this match, and I think I liked it a lot. I'm going to look up my review while you talk about it.
Yeah. So basically, we're in 2010, and to me, it sets up the entire what pro wrestling would become for the entire decade to come. And it's really the Motor City Machine Guns. I mean, they were really way ahead of their time when you watch that match today. And you had the Young Bucks who are they look like kids. I mean, Matt was 25, I believe. So Nick was maybe 21. I'm not sure how old he is now. I mean, he looks like a teenager. And what struck me is that, because for a long time, at first, I was like a lot of people, I didn't get the Young Bucks. And right now I'm getting it. But and I'm watching that match in 2020 for the first time, and it strikes me how her head totally ahead of its time it is, in terms of the spots and the quickness. And it's totally the Motor City Machine Girls to me. The generation me, young boys at the time, were cleanly learning from the Motor City Machine Guns. It's really a long tag team name for me to say.
And basically, yes, long tag team name for anyone to say. Yeah.
Yeah. MCMG, anyway. So it's fascinating to me to see that the Young Bucks were actually already insanely good workers back then. And they were actually playing heels in this match. And I guess it would anger a lot of people, but they were basically the Midnight Express already. And the other one were the Fantastics. To me, it's basically Midnight Express, Fantastics, but only 2010 version of it. Basically, that's it. And it's pretty much, yeah, I put this match in 2020. Some spots don't look dated, but you can see that it's not 2020, but in terms of how quick it is, how the insanity of some of the combination they do, the Bucks and the other one, it could happen today. In some people would say, yeah, too many moves and it goes too fast, blah, 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 blah. And the other one would say, great match, even 2020. And it was 10 years ago. And it was back then when in TNA you had AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, Chris Daniels, Kurt Angle, Hulk Hogan, which is insane to think that the Young Bucks and Hulk Hogan were in the same company at the same time. I think it's totally forgotten now, but actually they were. And to me, I watched this match. So great match and pretty much classic, because although at the end they do a ending stretch with a ton of spots, and I mean, that's their game. But still, the basic dynamic at first, it's Gen Me, the Young Bucks, are total dick heels. And they are controlling the pace and cutting the ring in half. And and Sabin and Shelley are playing babyface in parallel. But of course, in the second half, yes, you spot. And it's even better than any Beer Money Shelley Sabin match to me. So, which
I'm glad you agree with that. Yep, I agree with you.
Were already excellent, but to me, yeah, it was like, okay, so this is where pro wrestling is going in this decade. And the history proved them right, basically. And it's funny because the Shelley and Sabin are back in Impact. They've come back a few months ago. And it showed that they were way ahead of their time, because they are still great workers today. I mean, Sabin was before 40 or something. Shelley is maybe a little bit younger, but I don't know. But they don't look from another era at all. To me, I guess they were very inspired by the juniors of Noah, I think. To me, if people want to complain about the fact that everything goes too fast and they are doing overcomplicated spots and sequences, to me, people should blame Kenta and Maro Fuji, I believe.
I agree with that, yes.
And to me, when I think about the first guy who really... And to me, it's kind of genius, actually, to use the ring, the space of the ring, in different ways that we've never seen before, in the ropes, and to work around the ropes and around the ring. And for instance, like the whole misdirection thing, when you run in the same direction as the other guy to get him on the rebound. I think it's Maru Fuji who did that first. I'm not sure, but I could be wrong. But I think.
Yeah, you might be right. I think it was him. So I hate that spot. But
I love that.
Oh yeah, I don't like that. I always think it looks really clunky and not realistic. But yeah, to each their own. Yeah, but I think you're right. Yeah, I have a real issue with Maro Fuji. Kenta, I'm like 50-50 on. Sometimes I love ass kicking Kenta, but then there's other times where he's just like, oh, it's just like constantly spots that don't mean anything.
I have one thing to say.
Yeah,
I should say it right now.
Go ahead.
My pet peeve when I hear the argument that, oh, but heels shouldn't do flashy moves, okay? Or shouldn't do the flashiest move in a match, okay? So in this match, clearly, Jenmi, Young Bucks are the heels, and it's not a spot match. It's really you have babyface and heels.
Yep.
And the Young Bucks are great dick heels. I mean, they really are.
Yep.
But Then I'm thinking, okay, so I guess it goes back to the classic years of the 80s or whatever. And then I'm thinking, okay, so what is the absolute classic feud of the 80s, tag team wrestling? So Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express.
Of course, yep.
Okay. So would you tell me, by being honest, which team had the most impressive, ahead of their time, flashiest, and most acrobatic spots between the two teams?
Oh, Midnight Express was definitely a better offensive team than Rock and Roll Express.
Yeah. Midnight Express, well, like, they had the cool spots. They had the coolest spots of, I mean, there are coolest spots that Rock and Roll, because Rock and Roll Express, basically, Ricky Morton was like, he's one of the greatest workers ever to me.
Of course.
I mean, really, like, this guy, the other guy, Robert Gibson, all credit due. I mean, this guy was like lucky to be there because you could put, I mean, a lot of other workers from the era. And because, for instance, the Fantastics, I think, now I'm really talking old stuff, but I think it's more, there are different kind of worker, but they both brought a lot to the table, Tommy Rogers and Bobby Fulton, I think.
Right, yeah, I think Rogers is a little bit more work rate.
His own way.
Yep.
But still, I think the Midnight Express, they had the coolest spots, they had the most, way ahead of their time. It's like in 1990, since Tracy's mother passed away a few weeks ago, days ago, the infamous Southern Boys versus the Midnight Express match. Same thing. I mean, it could be this kind of match too, where you have heels, of course, but they do like the craziest and most advanced, showing up all the other guy on the card. And they are the coolest ones, the Midnight Express. Of course, they are the flashiest ones. So, you know what? This argument, the heel shouldn't do the flashy stuff. Yeah, but when I think about like the greatest team of all time are from the classic era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, my defense of what I was saying is I think there is a little bit of nuance. I'm not totally against heels doing cool stuff. I would prefer the babyface doing cool stuff, but if the heels do cool stuff, it can work. I was more like annoyed when it's meaningless.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but the actually I looked up my reviews. So I liked this match a lot, and I actually liked their previous match in September. I don't know if you saw that. A lot too. That's the one where the Young Bucks actually turn heel on the Machine Guns. Mm-hmm. So I liked both a lot, and I agree with you. A lot of the things I wrote and my general recollection was this is actually very 80s, just updated for the time period. And like you point out, the first one was Babyface versus Babyface in September. October, the Young Bucks were great heels, and one of the spots that I noticed in reading this is the way they turned heel was they DDT'd Shelley on the floor to injure his neck. If you look at what spot it was that got them to their heat segment in October, it was a DDT from the top rope on Shelley. Yeah. So they're tying in that injury to the neck. But see, that's the thing, and then this is what I'm totally fine with. In 1985, if you do that match, it's a simple DDT on the canvas. In 2010, we've upgraded that DDT from coming off the top rope.
It's not even a DDT.
Yeah.
I mean, in 85, it's not even a DDT, I think. I mean, DDT in 85 was death.
That's true. You're right. You're right. It would just be like a punch to the back of the neck. Would probably be
enough. Oh, neck breaker.
Yeah, or neck breaker. Yeah, exactly. Which is actually, kind of funny is I don't like I'm not a huge neck breaker guy, especially swinging neck breakers. I always think they're kind of lame. So,
I was thinking like the neck breaker, like in the Rick Woods
like
style.
Neck breaker, yeah. But so, anyways, I liked both matches. And actually, one thing that kind of shocked me about AEW is that I love the Young Bucks. Like when
I mean, people say, well, they're going to work with FTR and they're going to learn how to work tag team wrestling. I'm like, facepalm. Now, come on.
I agree with you. I know that a lot of people think that all I do is rail against spot fests, but I like a good spot fest, but they're actually not that spotty. A lot of their stuff makes lot of sense. They're very – the thing that really elevates them from a lot of the Spotfest guys is how urgent they hit it and how quick and sudden everything is. A lot of people, it's you can actually, like, watch, especially people who are just learning how to wrestle, like, the wheels turn. Like, if you ever watch Private Party, you can actually watch them think about the spot they have to hit. And it's kind of – it takes me out because I've watched so much wrestling, so I can actually tell that that's what's going on. Bucks are so experienced, and they're so quick, and there's not a lot of cooperation. You see a lot of dives that are just totally out of nowhere. I like the Bucks a lot. And what's really interesting is that 10 years earlier – I know that they started really young, but even in 2010, they knew what they were doing. They are a very good team.
They were absolutely still. I mean, it's obvious when you see that, when you watch that match, it's obvious that they have digested. And that's very millennials. I can't say it in English. Millennials. So to digest like pop culture and stuff, because you can watch everything now on YouTube. And in 2010, YouTube, but you can download everything already. Because you can see that they have digested every Midnight Express match they could. Because, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you actually – so there's two things I want to bring up. One is if you had to ask me who's the better tag team, Young Bucks or FTR, based on what I've seen – and I have not watched FTR's NXT, and I understand that you really do need to watch that to understand them. But watching FTR's WWE and AEW Dynamite, I think the Young Bucks are a way better tag team. So that's – I know that it might be better for you.
The other two are just awesome too. But, yeah, to me they're like insanely great.
Yeah. And then the other thing that is interesting that you brought up was a lot of people really, really love the Motor City Machine Guns versus Beer Money, specifically that 2 out of 3 falls match. You see that in a lot of top 10 lists. And I thought it was very good. I thought it was a solid match. But I was like, it never crossed the line to great to me. And I thought both of the Machine Guns versus Bucks matches, the one from September and the one you had from October, were substantially better than the Beer Money match. So I'm glad we agree on that.
I'm kind of guilty because I did not rewatch that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't take notes back then. So my notes of 2010 was basically, the Young Bucks and Motor City Machine Gun, we like killed it, and that was match of the year. I didn't take the time to rewatch Beer Money against Sabin and Shane. That's an impossible name to say. Because I really loved it. But so maybe if I watch it back, maybe it would have made the list, or maybe not. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But obviously, when I was like, okay, so 2010, what was it about? Basically, these two or three matches. And I was very surprised because 10 years ago, they had the Young Bucks and AJ Styles and Samoa Joe. Come on, how can you screw that up?
I know, especially AJ. They had AJ Styles as the world champion at the beginning of that year, but that's too bad.
Samoa Joe, they totally screwed. I mean, we're going to talk about it later, I'm sure. Yeah. But they totally screwed Samoa Joe. Like,
they did. All right, let's. I'll move on to my 14.
Yep.
So my 14, it actually comes. It's my most recent match to make the list. It's from 2018. Impact World Champion Austin Aries versus Johnny Impact, aka John Morrison, for those who don't follow Impact. Johnny Knight, tons of names. And this is from Bound for Glory 2018. This is the fuck you match at the end.
Yeah, Austin Aries, always a great professional.
This is Austin Aries at the height of his douchebaggery.
I know that match, so I'm going to be able to talk about it a little bit. I did not put it in my list. I'm just going to say that right now, and then you can talk about it. The one thing I really can't stand about John Morrison, Impact, Nitro, whatever, it's finisher. It's like it ruins every finish match when he wins to me, because his finisher is like one of the worst. Like, he doesn't even touch his opponent. Like,
you know why that's really funny? Because Austin Aries totally agrees with you.
Okay.
So I'll start at the end.
So I can understand why he popped up.
I'll start at the end.
It's great. It's incredibly difficult to do. It's great athletic spot, but as a pro wrestling especially finisher. I mean, did he touch his opponent? I'm not sure.
I agree with you. The spot sucks. I mean, yeah. I don't even like split-legged moonsaults normally. Like, split-legged moonsaults don't look good ever.
Yeah.
I've seen like one good split-legged moonsault like in my entire life.
Yeah.
But they're not good.
It seems like the guy who's doing it is like busting his knees.
Busting his knees, and then it always like they never land properly. They always land like on their knees. It's just terrible. But anyways, so let's talk about the finish first. So Austin Aries was leaving the company, or he was in the middle of contract negotiations, I should say.
Yeah, I believe you.
And so spoiler, Impact wins the world title with Starship Pain, the stupid move. And Aries pops right up, flips off Don Callis, flips off the fans, and walks out. Okay. And you can actually see John Morrison say, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Which was hilarious.
Actually, it's hilarious. Yeah. Did he flip off the fans?
He flipped off the fans too. He flipped off Don Callis for sure. And I think as he was walking up the ramp, he was flipping off the fans.
Because what's actually quite funny, it's the way he gets up and it's very casual, you know? It's like, okay, no, I'm going out.
Yeah, it is. But he definitely was
like, okay, no, I'm going to have drink at the bar or something. Blah, 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 blah. It doesn't even try to. Okay, I'm done.
So I didn't know about that. So, like, I usually go in cold to matches, so I had no idea this was going to happen. But, like, so this strikes me as odd. So I'm like, oh, I should do a little research. So I do a little research on it, you know, type into Google. And there's a 45-minute fucking conversation between Austin Aries and Killer Cross. I did not watch the 45-minute conversation.
Whoa.
But somebody wrote down the highlights. So if I get the highlights wrong, all right, somebody should tell me I got it wrong. But I at least read the highlights. So basically the problem was Austin Aries sent out a tweet that was a heelish tweet. Don Callis said it crossed the line and told him to take the tweet down. Austin Aries got annoyed because, you know, how can I be a heel if I can't say mean things? And it's like that whole like back and forth thing. And I don't want to get into debate about it because it could last forever. But so he gets pissed about this. There's the contract negotiations. So he's just like pissed. So in the transcript, he goes, that Starship Pain, I can't remember the way he said it, but he said it to this effect. Do you see what I had him hit me with before Starship Pain? I had him hit me with the Brain Buster because there's no man alive who would actually get pinned by fucking Starship Pain. That's why I had him hit me with my move because that's a real move. I was like, okay, it's pro wrestling, dude. But then he said, and that's why I popped up because Conor McGregor doesn't just sit there and just take it. I'm going to pop up. And plus, it was Starship Pain. It's the weakest move. I'm not going to sell that shit. And I was just like, he just rails against Starship Pain for like, or at least in the transcript, it seemed like a lot. So it was pretty funny.
Yeah, actually, and it's not, on that point, it's not wrong. I mean, it really looks like shit.
Yeah, so the "Are you fucking kidding me?" from John Morrison is so priceless.
Yeah, Oscar, yeah, that, yeah, that's too good. What the?
So, anyways, there was a great match before the finish. I did not include it in my list just because of the finish. So, what I really liked about the beginning is really what kind of got it launched up into this position. The rest of the match was good, but the beginning was like super good. It was basically, shoot style brawling. In 2018, Morrison having a shoot style brawl is like the most bizarre thing in the world to me, but it happened. It was really good. A lot of struggle, a lot of grappling. They were just like two battering rams constantly. Like one time Morrison goes for like a double leg takedown, like a really like vicious one, and Aries just locks on this guillotine and they're just like wrestling and it's just chaos. It looks like the Tasmanian devil and there's like a cloud of dust. And what it basically comes down to is Austin Aries, the aforementioned tweet was Austin Aries basically called the way John Morrison dressed as gay, which is, I think, the reason why Don Callis wanted the tweet taken down. And he also called his wife fat. Well, the exact words he used was husky. So there's also fat shaming involved, too. The reason Aries sent out the tweet was because Morrison made fun of his height. And Aries said, that's not fair because in how come in 2018 I can't say you're gay and she's fat, but you can still make fun of me for being short? So the point is, he's a heel. He wasn't saying that honestly or truthfully. He was saying it as a heel, and that was his point. So anyways, so let's not, I don't want to get too much into it. But so because of the what I liked about it was Morrison was bringing the fire and the anger. He wasn't treating the tweet like, oh, that was just nothing. Like, he was pissed. Like, he called my wife fat. Like, I'm going after him. And for the record, Taya is a very attractive lady. She is not fat. No, I do not think that. I don't think anyone else thinks that.
She's awesome.
Very athletically fit. Great lady. Great wrestler, too. She's not a great top 25, but she's a great wrestler. She really is.
She has developed in Impact to the point where she's like a total star. She can do anything, heel, face, comedy, whatever. She's great. She's awesome.
So Aries, and so, like I said, there was just a lot of, like, intensity in those first 5 minutes. Oh, there's this great spot where normally, you know how people just catch you on the outside when you do a dive? Like, Aries is just walking around, and Morrison just dives on him. I'm like, that's the type of, like, intensity I want. Also, he finally uses parkour in an interesting way. Usually, Morrison's use of parkour is, like, the most annoying thing. Yeah. But he does this split where he leapfrogs Aries on the outside, splits on the apron and the guardrail, and then does a backflip into a pay light. And it's like seamless, smooth, and he nails the pay light. It looked great. But what's nice is Morrison gets caught with way too much flying eventually. And that's when Aries just starts wrestling mean. And if you ever notice how Austin Aries chops, I love it. He feigns with the right hand, like to do a right knife edge chop, and he comes through with the left overhand. And it creates this great whipping motion. Mm. It looks cool as hell. And he really smacks him. So I love how he chops. He did a lot of that. Taya was great on the outside. She flips Aries off at one point, screams, fuck you. Like, she really was selling the heat of the match, which I liked a lot. And then Aries, so like I said, Aries was just a great heel, and that eventually set up Morrison for going for the jazzy moves. So eventually Morrison loves the Spanish fly. I actually like John Morrison a lot. I think his knee strikes and his strikes in general are pretty good. Sometimes he goes a little too jazzy, but, like, you know, fine, everything in moderation. He really loves the Spanish fly. I'm not a huge Spanish fly guy, but so that's fine. But the finish I thought was really, really good. It was very symmetrical. Each man hit their finishing sequence only for the other man to grab the rope. So you get that symmetry. They both get the near falls. It's tied one apiece. You know you're headed into the finish. What's going to happen? You get the last chancery in front of Taya. So that looks great. You know, you have the wife urging him on. Aries is staring a hole into her. And the next thing you know, this was could have been set up a little bit better, but I still liked it, was she just – Aries does his big skyrocket suicide dive but smokes Taya. So this triggers Morrison to beat the shit out of him, and that's when the brainbuster shard champagne happens. I mean, honestly, what I think really was it was just so heated. It was such a randomly hot match where these two guys looked super pissed at each other, and maybe it's because of the backstage stuff, and that's why they were pissed at each other. I have no freaking clue, but it came off great in terms of the way they wrestled.
Wow, you make it sound like it's really a truly great match. It's funny because I saw that match. I didn't rewatch it because – in my mind, I was never a huge fan of John Morrison as a babyface. I think he was a much better heel. To me, I'm not going to say that often because usually it's a criticism that I don't agree with. But to me, there is a part of John Morrison's work that actually looks a little bit too smooth to me. And the parkour, I can say parkour because it's French, so sorry. Yeah. The parkour stuff, yeah, it's fun, but it really looks like parkour. It's a guy jumping from dun, 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 dun. And so, for instance, it's like when he's doing his knee, you know, his, there is like the way the guy is on the mat and he's running and and I don't know how to explain it, but it's like he's losing momentum. I don't know. There is something that it doesn't look right to me.
Okay, fair enough.
So I like him much better as a heel because he's actually a really good heel, and it's less focused on doing like – he does the fancy stuff, of course, because that's his game. But in a much less so obvious way. But some of it looks really cool, but some of it looks kind of, yeah, yes, parkour, okay. That's fun, but too smooth to me. So that's why maybe it didn't hit me like that when I was watching it. I usually like Austin Aries' work a lot.
Yeah, so. I think Aries is great, actually. I mean, it's a shame that he's an absolute asshole, but... he's a good wrestler.
And he's a great promo, too.
He is, too. I agree with that. Aries reminds me a lot of a smaller Benoit. Just like a pit bull, just constantly going forward, hitting hard.
More charisma, though.
Yeah, a little bit more charisma. I think Benoit sometimes gets a little underrated in the charisma department. But, yeah, he is more charismatic than Benoit. That's true, too.
Yeah. I have a great idea for Austin Aries. Great idea of gimmick match.
What's that?
The vaccine death match. Vaccine. Like you do a board, you do a board, all these old FMW death match, you do a board with a bunch of syringe, with anti-flu vaccine, and you have to throw the opponent on the vaccine, and at the end, Austin Aries bumps on the syringe, and he gets vaccinated.
I mean, that would be the ultimate diss to him. I don't know if he would take the, I don't know if he would do the job.
No, or maybe a bunch of masks, and you have to rub his face on the mask, you know.
Well, the other thing is, well, if you have him up against Loki, right? Both are pretty notorious.
Oh my God, yeah.
Job. That would be pretty funny.
Talk about the two guys from the Indies who never made it anywhere else because they are great workers, but total douchebag.
Oh my God! The one thing that's really interesting to me, and maybe you'll prove me wrong. We still have 13 more matches to go, but Loki to me in 2002. Should have been like the greatest wrestler of all time, and it's like shocking to me that I've never found a really great Loki match from TNA.
Do you
have one? Oh no. Yeah, I know it's really.
It was serious, but
2002 Loki is like phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, anyways, yeah. Did you have anything else to say about?
No.
No. Okay.
No, but I really maybe I'm thinking maybe I missed something.
I really like the beginning and the ending. I will admit that the middle kind
of the beginning now that I do remember
yeah.
That.
Yeah. Anyways, so what's your number 14?
Oh, it's going to be a little bit different. It's Sami Callihan versus Tessa Blanchard from Slammiversary 2019, obviously.
I see. Yes. So I know this match.
It's the first match they had together.
Yes. I know this match is famous. I don't want to get into a big debate. I'm not super keen on intergender wrestling, so I didn't watch it. But I'm cool with anybody who puts it on their list, but I haven't seen it. So you can go ahead and talk about it.
I know it's kind of controversial for some people. But to me, it was Tessa, like I said, was, she is still, I guess, an awesome worker, kind of like Gail Kim in the way that she will sell but never quit. And she will really, I mean, in this match, so basically the story of this match is, can Tessa Blanchard, can she hang out with Sami Callihan? And he's like the old Sami Callihan. So he's going to torture her, really. He's going to beat her up. So I guess that's why some people are uncomfortable with it. But to me, since it's not a real sport, it's like they're like, I don't know, like comic book characters or anything. At some point, it's pure fiction. It doesn't mean anything other than what it is. You know, it's like it could be an anime or whatever. I understand why some people wouldn't like it, but to me it's like two pro wrestlers, and that's how they work the match, basically. And so he's extremely vicious, he's extremely disgusting, like he always is. Tessa Blanchard, she's such a great babyface. I mean, she's been a great heel, and in this match you can see she is crying her eyes out. She's selling, but she's always kind of like Gail Kim. She's always bringing back the fight to Kalyan, and at some, and it's in super intense. And you know Kalyan's work, and you know Tessa's work, and they really click. I mean, it's again, it's kind of like the perfect match, although, yes, it's intergender. But there is an intensity that you very seldom see these days. And the guy, Sami Callihan, it's not a plus for you, I mean, as a heel, working as a heel, is not... Again, his stuff looks brutal. It's a lot of snap to it, a lot of intensity to it. It's not very fancy. And it does a lot of submission work. So you can see Tessa going for the rope and crying. And the audience goes absolutely crazy for her. I mean, that program, for the Impact audience, at least it worked. Because the emotion, it's insane. We're talking about pure heat. And again, we often hear that, but oh, there is no real heat right now. It's like people enjoy the match for the match, but they are not pushing for the babyface. In this case, it's like the total opposite. Everybody is like pushing for Tessa. Every comeback she does, the crowd goes insane. She's so intense on everything she does. And of course, it cuts her off every time, and they build and they build and they build. So it's a super intense match. Everything they do looks super crisp and super hard. I mean, she's not afraid. And what's great about Sami Callihan, he's absolutely not afraid to sell, to show total ass for Tessa, to bump for her when it's necessary. And it looks good because her stuff looks awesome. She's very physical as a women's wrestler. There's not a lot like her. I mean, obviously, I mean, she was trained with men. I think she was trained with Brian Cage or something like that. So she's used to work with men, and it shows. So she can really go all out on Callihan, and he's going to sell. When it's time to sell, he's selling, and they absolutely build it to a climax. At the end, Callihan will win that match, but it's like an all-time great underdog babyface being tortured by a vicious heel, and the crowd is going insane for it. There's tons of hits, so... I mean, to me, it's very ballsy because it was the main event of they have two pay-per-views a year right now. So it was the main event. It was the big match they have built for like months. And it could not have been better to me.
Wow.
And they really work so well together. And you can see that Callihan also, his stuff looks really vicious. And I mean, it does the package pipe driver and stuff, but it also looks safe. And you can see that he's taking care of her.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
He's really an underrated worker. I mean, pure as far as pure in-ring work, I think Callihan is actually a great worker. But you don't think about it like spontaneously because, it's, like I said, it's not very flashy. It's a lot of brawling stuff. And but if you really pay attention, you can see that except, yes, the accident with Eddie Edwards, which it was an accident. But it seems like really like kind of a worker. Like it looks brutal, but it actually must be pretty safe. I think that's my take.
I agree with you. I think the accident actually helped his aura, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because I went and saw him during Mania weekend last year in New York. And honestly, I just saw this, like, I'd only seen, like, how crazy he was in the bat, and I was like, oh my god, this guy's, like, actually violent. Like, it really made me feel like, oh, I'm, like, scared. Like, I was second row for the show. I was like, I'm kind of scared being in the second row with this guy, like, being a total maniac. And he was actually, like, really convincing, even, like, up close live. He's so much spit, so gross. But when you watch, like, even the, like, unfortunately, I didn't watch this match, but, like, even the Pentagon match, like, that screwdriver stuff he did was very safe. Like you could tell, like he was doing it the correct way. But as for the testing, I mean, you really sold that match well. You actually made the match seem like it should be top 10 or top 5. Like you, that was a lot of praise, and it seemed very well earned.
I've not finished with these two.
Oh, I see. They do have a rematch. That is true. And to be honest with you, if you're going to – so I live in Boston. So the local independent promotion is Beyond Wrestling, which a lot of these people have wrestled for. Like I saw Brian Cage wrestle for Beyond Wrestling one time. So I've seen a lot of these guys because of that. And they have at least one intergender match, a show. And it's not like I turned my eyes away from it. You know, I paid my ticket. I'm here. I'm going to support the wrestlers. So I'm not completely against it. But I'm going to say, if you're going to do it, I would much rather the woman be the babyface. Because at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're cheering for her. You want her to make the comeback. What kind of grosses me out is when the woman's the heel and you should be cheering for her to get her ass kicked. That's when it gets weird for me. So when the woman's the babyface, I'm definitely more inclined to like it.
And if you consider this as like strictly two pro wrestler, you don't care about gender, okay? To strictly wrestler, the story about the vicious heel and the underdog babyface.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, it's like a great match. I mean, there are.
No, you made it sound like it was absolutely amazing.
Oh, yeah. She's got so much fire. I mean, she has so much fire. Everything she does, to me, it's like, it seems like it's real. I mean, to her. I mean, the facials, the cry, because she's, when he's putting the submission on her, she's like crying and she's like Ricky Morton selling. But at the same time, she's not dying like Ricky Morton. Because she's Tessa, okay? So she's going to fight back, and she's super physical. I mean, it's really super intense. And even, like, for instance, like I said about John Morrison, the problem with John Morrison, like, most of his time, his stuff looks a little bit cute to me. Tessa, and especially in this match, because it, like, was really a struggle, it looked like a struggle. Like, really? Yeah. So everybody's pulling for her, and even though I'm sure there was this is awesome chance. I mean, I don't remember. I'm sure there was. But it was not about the match. I mean, they were absolutely pulling for Tessa to win because she was the baby face against this disgusting, spitting, like, piece of trash of a human being. And he's so good at it. And she's so good at being the fiery baby face. I mean, she could be, like, the biggest star in WWE tomorrow.
Well, I agree. I mean, Tessa versus Charlotte writes itself, right?
Oh.
I mean, I think you start with the tag team there, and then one turns on the other. I mean, Tessa versus Charlotte would just be monumental, massive.
Yeah, that's a match I would even I would go back on my because I have no interest in WWE right now. But if Tessa were there and they would do that match, I would absolutely watch it.
Yeah. She is great. I really hope. I mean, she's young, and I mean, I remember being in my 20s. Not that I had attitude problems in my 20s, but you know, you kind of think you know everything, and hopefully, you know, a couple months, maybe a year or two of like experience and being like, you know what, I can chill a little bit, and turn that attitude around. She still has plenty of good years ahead of her, so hopefully,
she's like 25 or something.
Yeah, so hopefully, she can get her head screwed on straight, and we can all enjoy her wrestling. Okay, so my 13 is a interesting match because honestly, I overlooked it for a very long time, and the only reason I watched it is because Dave Meltzer gave it 4.5 stars, and I couldn't believe he gave this match 4.5 stars, but it is deserved. It is awesome. It is NWA World Tag Team Champions, Team Canada, Bobby Roode and Eric Young versus America's Most Wanted from 2005.
Wow. Eric Young again.
That's true. This is – I actually like – this Eric Young was very bland.
Yeah.
He wasn't nuts yet.
At the beginning, that's why. In Team Canada, he was really good. And then, it's L for like 15 years, I guess, or 10.
Do you have this match?
No, absolutely not. I have seen it a long time ago, but
– yes. So Eric Young is not doing a crazy gimmick. He's just like a normal generic heel. Same goes for Bobby Roode. My general recollection from this time period, because I did watch, was that Team Canada was pretty like basic. You know, they were just like I get Bret Hart was really good at it, but like Canadian heels don't really make a lot of sense. I mean, Canada and America aren't that different. So, but anyways, so they were the heels because they were from Canada, which is kind of a lame reason to be a heel. But America's Most Wanted is freaking awesome. We've already talked about how great they are. I have a couple more America's Most Wanted matches. They're great. What I really liked about this match was it was just like the perfect babyface heel match. And they just started off hot and they just built and built. And the impact zone was rocking. Roode and Young were basically the best stooge heels of the 21st century in this. This was total Southern fried wrestling, all the trimmings, just like big bumps, tons of like goofy, like Midnight Express type spots that work though. They started the match right on the outside, like AMW rushed Team Canada on the ramp. They're just brawling on the outside. Young was just bumping around everywhere. There's these great spots where they kept throwing Young and Rude into each other. I think at one point somebody's head goes into somebody else's nuts. It was just hilarious, and they were doing such a great job.
Classic spot of in TNA. With Bill Monet, they were doing the same kind of stuff.
Yes. Which is crazy to think about, because obviously they didn't know it at the time. But 5 years later, Bobby Roode and James Storm would be a super popular tag team. So, Team Canada uses the Hart Foundation sliding knee, which I really liked as the transition. I watched a lot of WWF tag team matches, so. I know the Bret Hart sliding knee well, and so it's cool that Team Canada used that. Really good heat segment on James Storm, and there's just this great moment where he hits an enziguri on Rude and then an enziguri on Young, and they both do flare flops. One does it in the ring, the other does it on the apron, and it was just awesome. Storm was still too beaten up, and they like yank him back. You know, they really build to the hot tag, which is like something people don't really do anymore. Like back in the day, I know it became a cliche, but it'd be nice to like do some of it. It's like, you know, you do the tag, but the ref doesn't see it. You know, you do the almost get there tag, you do the yank away. Like there's just so many things you can do to build to that. And I just don't feel like people do it anymore. But once Harris does get the tag, it's just a monster hot tag. Oh, and I think we talked about this a little bit before, but when you watch this hot tag, especially in early 2005, you're shocked. I'm shocked that Harris didn't have a bigger singles run. He looked great.
Yeah.
And Rude and Young, like I said, were just these bumping, feeding machines. And then I really liked the finish. The finish was very like Southern, like Memphis style, with like a lot of like craziness. There was handcuffing Scott D'Amore to a post. Johnny Devine, who probably most people have forgotten, but was also part of Team Canada, he gets involved. There's all these near falls. We talked about the difference between near falls and like what we call them. These were real near falls because the crowd and me were going crazy. There was a couple times during this where they got me. Like I thought for sure that what was going to happen was that Team Canada was going to win on the hockey stick to the back, and then they were going to do a gimmick match the next month for AMW to win. But nope, they end up doing – that doesn't do it. Oh, no, this was the actual spot. It wasn't the hockey stick to the back that got me, because that was a good spot. But the one that got me was – Rude hits a lariat to the back of his head, and Harris lands head first on the chair. I was like, oh, that's a great finish. This should be the finish, and they'll go next month. Nope, he kicked out, and then they do a chair shot by accident to Eric Young, and then it's a roll up, 1-2-3. The pop was massive for America's Most Wanted victory. So just a really fun babyface versus heel match. And it's a hidden gem, because besides Meltzer's huge rating, I'd never heard about anyone going crazy for this.
Yeah, but what year was that?
2005 is January. Is the final.
Oh, 2005. Yeah, basically 2005 was the 2005 and the beginning of 2006 was the best year to me.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because Russo was gone by then, and it was Scott D'Amore who was booking.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I think so, yeah. And Russo came back in like 2007, I think. Something like that. But it was a period when the beginning of Impact, I think. And it was really fun. A really fun promotion. How did Bobby Roode he was like a great tag team worker, like you said.
Yeah, I don't know. But I feel like Bobby Roode
doing great. How did it became? Can I spoil your list? Do you have Bobby Roode the singles match in your list?
I do have a Bobby Roode singles match.
Okay, so we'll talk about that later. Okay.
We can talk about it later. The Bobby Roode singles match I have is we'll just talk about it later. It's interesting. To me, Bobby Roode somewhere along the line became Triple H Jr. He's just soulless like mechanic. Yeah, he's very similar to Triple H. Like, Triple H he is possible to have a great match with. It's just he doesn't usually add a lot to it.
Yeah, but as a tag wrestler, Bobby Roode, he was terrific. And he was terrific in Beer Money, too. Actually, it became better, which is kind of obvious. But he was already really good back then. He didn't have much in terms of charisma.
I think that's always been kind of his big issue. Is in similar, like Triple H does have charisma on the microphone. I think he can. Sometimes he's very long-winded, but he can be genuinely funny sometimes. It's in the ring. The dude has zero charisma.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I never got it.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate. I mean, same thing goes with Chris Harris. Like, I know he had that really terrible run in WWE, but, like, dude looked like a million bucks.
A guy who has a terrible run, and that's his fault, of course. You hear Bruce Pritchard talk about, oh, but that was his fault. Okay.
Yo, yeah, I know. But what's weird is he didn't come back to TNA. He did come back to TNA. I do remember that.
With Beer Money against whoever. He was a surprise tag team partner of Matt Hardy, actually.
Yeah, and he didn't click again, so I don't know. It's very odd. I've always liked James Storm. I think he has a good look, so, you know, but anyways.
Yeah, the Team Canada was fun, and it's funny because you say, I don't understand why the Canadian are heels, and basically it's from 1997, Bret Hart.
That's right, it's basically the reason.
After that point, it was like the laziest booking ever. Oh, we have a bunch of Canadians, giving them a Canadian flag, and they're going to be heels. He has, for no other reason than the Hart Foundation in 97, but there was a purpose. I mean, there was a reason back then for the Hart Foundation.
It was, yeah, and that was a good reason. That was the good version of USA versus Canada.
At that point, it was like Canadian flag, heels. Okay, whatever. But it was always funny to me because from now on, Canadians mean heels just because of Bret Hart, basically.
That's true.
It's kind of funny, yeah.
What's your number 13?
Okay, my number 13. So it's a gimmick that I usually don't like, don't enjoy at all. A triple threat match, I don't enjoy usually. So it's Samoa Joe, AJ Styles, Chris Daniels from 2009.
Okay, yep. So I had that earlier. So why don't you go first, and then I'll talk about it after you.
I have more notes than I do, so you can say a lot more. I think you have the 2009. You have it too. So,
yeah, I had it at number 20, so you had it higher. Yep.
Because it's to me, it's like it's a little bit like the when I talked about the last AJ Styles Chris Daniels match in 2012, it's a little bit the same thing. It's like 5 years, 4 years before, they had this like awesome match, which was legendary under quotation because it was TNA. And at this time, I'm going to give a little bit of context because it's interesting. It was just before Hulk Hogan was signed, or he was already signed, but he was coming in the beginning of 2010. And the booking, like, they kind of stopped. And they're like, okay, so we know that in 2010, everything's going to be like, how do you say, tabula rasa. I'm speaking Latin now.
Changed.
Yeah, they're going to change everything. And so for like the last month of 2009, what can we do which won't have any consequence in the future? So they basically went back to basics, and they were okay. So back then it was the X Division. Now AJ Styles is the world champion, so we're gonna put it Chris Daniels and Samoa Joe again, and basically for no other reason that it was great then. Okay, let's put them together again. So basically it was a redux of the match 4 years before, and likewise, it was kind of the same match, kind of the same dynamic a little bit. A little bit less impressive because it was the second time around. A little bit slower, not as creative maybe. By then, AJ Styles was, of course, great. Chris Daniels, he had been off and on. I think he was just coming back. He was still great. Samoa Joe was kind of wasted already. He had been at that point, so it was so exciting in 2005 because it was brand new. In 2009, it was okay. Samoa Joe, it's all kind of done already. It was still a great worker by then, but so basically it's the same match. I'm not a big fan of triple threat match because to me there's too much like cutesy spots and too much stuff that look awkward and way too choreographed. The thing is that with these three, which basically are the three of them were in Ring of Honor, right? Earlier in the decade.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes, they were in Ring of Honor together.
Yeah. So basically, it's like the dream match of the three of the greatest worker of the 2000s, from the indie scene. Basically, like I said, they're playing the hits a little bit. Chris Daniels also was kind of heelish, not straight heel, but like he always is. And basically, the same match as 4 years before, but a little bit less great than 4 years before for various reasons, like booking, which had kind of ruined Samoa Joe, and the fact that, it's like it's just the second part in a franchise. Usually it's not as good as the first movie. But.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is this is actually
great.
It's a great match. Yeah. You know what's interesting is this is actually their fourth triple threat match together. Do you remember that they had triple threat matches at Against All Odds and Destination X in 2006 also?
I totally forgot about those ones.
Yeah. So there's.
No, I remember one. I remember one of them, which was clearly not as good as the 2005.
Yeah, I agree. Neither of those two are actually as good. Actually, though, the Against All Odds one was really good because I like the psychology of it because enough time had passed. And so AJ and Daniels had become friendly. And so it was just AJ and Dan. Yes, 2006. AJ and Daniels teamed up to beat Joe in a triple threat match. So it had like a cool psychology to it because it was like, okay, we know that because Joe was undefeated at the point.
Yeah.
So that had a cool side. So shout out to Against All Odds 2006. The Destination X one I didn't really care for. I think that might have been Ultimate X, but I could be wrong. So don't quote me on that one. But Against All Odds was also really good. The one you were talking about, I agree with most of your points. I think the one little addition I would add to what you were saying is, at least in my opinion, so AJ had won the world championship. He was defending the world championship. And this match was more structured. I felt like the 2005 match was more about Samoa Joe, whereas the 2009 match is more about AJ Styles and trying to make AJ Styles the man. So AJ Styles is given more time in this one. He's the one who's shining the most, and he's also the one who has to overcome the most obstacles. Other than that, I agree. It's like I called it the lo-fi version of Unbreakable.
Yeah,
you know, it is. I thought it was like more heated. There was like more heat to it, but at the same time, it wasn't as energetic and it wasn't quite as balls to the wall. But there was a rolling cradle, I have to mention. I love rolling cradles, so there was a cool rolling cradle spot. But other than that, it was pretty much what you just said. And I just thought even the ending really speaks to AJ being the man because the finish is he hits both men with the springboard 450 and gets the win.
He
takes out both of them. So it really is more about AJ. But it's still awesome match. So I mean these three together. Oh, and the other thing I agree with you, triple threats I usually hate. But these three for whatever reason really could make the style work, even though the style is usually pretty bad.
Because they are three absolutely elite workers, I think. And they found a way to make it work in creative ways that is actually fun to watch and not too awkward because usually at least make it in three ways and first one gets eliminated and then if that was this way, okay. But the one gets the pin and the other one is like, nah. So in title match, the champion can lose without getting the pin. Nah, it's cheap. So I never really cared for that. And you have to thank Jim Cornette for that one. Because he's the first one who did it. So thanks for nothing, Cornette.
So I'll move on to my number 12.
Yep.
All right, so my number 12 actually involves two of these people. I can't remember if you already said this one or not, so go ahead and correct me. It's AJ Styles versus Christopher Daniels, and this is Destination X 2011.
Oh, so I have it a little bit higher than you.
Awesome. Okay, cool. What's your number 12?
I think you will have it too. So I think we're going to switch back to your match, actually.
Okay.
So my number 12 is America's Most Wanted versus Chris Daniels and Elix Skipper, the Forgotten Elix Skipper, which were called Triple X because it was Vince Russo's stupid gimmick. which from the beginning. So Six Sides of Steel at Turning Point 2004, so very early. I guess you have this match.
Yeah, I do have this match. So, I'll go to number 11.
So you can go to number 11 because my number 11 is actually AJ Styles versus Christopher Daniels, Destination X
2011.
Yeah.
Okay.
2011. Yeah.
All right. So we can just talk about this all together because this works out really well. Because my number 11 is AJ Styles versus Christopher Daniels, Destination X 2012.
Wait.
I had 2011 at 12 and 2012 at 11. That sounds confusing as now that I've said this out.
So do we have 2012?
I thought you had Destination.
Yes, it's my number 24. Okay.
That was your number 24. Okay, cool. So let's just talk about the two Destination X matches together.
Yeah,
sure. I'll go first, then you can go second. So what's cool about this is they're exactly 1 year apart, and they couldn't be more different. 2011 is the Mutual Respect babyface versus babyface match. And then over the course of the year, Christopher Daniels, due to jealousy and all this stuff, becomes a very bitter heel, and that's what creates the Last Man Standing. So there's this really nice one-year character arc for the feud. So it's really cool. Starting with the 2011 match, so like I said, it's a Mutual Respect match, babyface versus babyface. And what's really cool about it is because of their best friendship, they were World Tag Team Champions, rivals in 2005. They all their moves are super well scouted. And so it actually forced them, and so few wrestlers can actually say that they did this. They both wrestle a completely different match than they normally would because the other keeps countering their normal spots. Yeah. So an easy example of this is everybody who's watched AJ Styles, especially somebody who's watched as much as me, all know at the beginning we're going to get the drop down. The person's going to run over AJ, and AJ is going to hit that drop kick. That's like the most typical start to an AJ match is the drop down drop kick. And I loved how Daniels knows that's going to happen. He avoids it, and then AJ forces the drop kick, but he forces in such a way that he doesn't get a very good angle on the drop kick and doesn't get the full extension. And so there's a lot of this going on where they're doing a lot of weird things that don't look right because they have to hit things from odd angles. Like another example is Daniels hits a very small suicide dive kind of through the bottom rope and just catches AJ off guard, and it tackles him, but he doesn't really do much damage. Daniel sprints back into the ring and then it jumps over the top rope and really hits him. The idea was, I think, to set up the bigger spot by doing a smaller spot, which I thought was really cool because he uses the surprise in the first one. So by the time AJ gets up for the big one, he can't move. And another cool examples of this is like AJ uses a Fujiwara armbar because a lot of his stuff keeps getting countered. And I've never seen AJ, and I've watched like pretty much every AJ Styles match probably. And I've never seen him do that. Daniels, I know, has used the Koji clutch before, but in this case, he goes to a crossface again because he couldn't get anything going. So it's a lot of brand new moves, a lot of like interesting angles. And so they don't do a lot of stock high spots. This is not a greatest hits match. It's almost like the exact opposite. None of the greatest hits are working.
Yeah, exactly.
So they have to do they have to do different moves. And the finish is really good. It's best moonsault ever going into he ends up hitting the knees, goes for a spot. The Styles Clash hits, doesn't get the finish. So then AJ does a springboard 450. That eats knees. Goes for the Angel's Wings, again, not the finish, and then they build to the Spiral Tap. So it's really a cool babyface versus babyface match. And then Last Man Standing, what's great about these two is this match could not have been more different than the match I already just talked about. This is violent. It's all about punching. There's no big high spots. It's double juice. There's blood. It's like a Southern Fried, blood-filled brawl, hate-filled, and it's just like, wow, like those dudes were just doing this crazy like technical match with like dives and submissions, and now we're just like, you know, kicking ass, working cuts, punching, and AJ's punches are great.
Yes.
He's a super underrated puncher. That his overhand right is so good and really good. And then Daniel's punch was really good. Daniel's had this one punch that started the heat segment that was so good that in the way AJ sold it was so well, you knew you were going into the heat segment. You knew something meaningful was happening. And it really, the punches were really good. It was the selling of the punches by both men that were so good. It's last man standing. What makes a really good last man standing is don't do too many 10 counts. They don't do that. It's a lot of shots to the head. They use Kazarian because at this point he was involved. They get rid of him eventually, and AJ's able to overcome both of them. And then it's just a really cool finish with the Styles Clash from the ramp through the table on the floor. So it's a big – so basically it's very like fundamental, basic brawling, barroom brawl, violent, but you build to that one big spot. So, I mean, kudos to these guys. I'm hard pressed to think of. There's so many people who people claim are versatile, but they basically wrestle the same match over and over again. These guys to have such different matches constantly with each other is really it impresses me, and that's why they're two of the best of all time.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more. That's why basically the Destination X 2011 is number 11 on my list because, like you said, it was totally different from what they did before. Which was kind of crazy because you would expect playing the hits like they kind of did in the last in the very last match, which is
they did in the very last match. Yes, yeah. That was the greatest.
But this one, again we are again 6 years after the first big legendary feud, and they are doing plus you have to say it was they were bringing back basically the X Division. It was another occurrence of all it's rebuild the X Division. And so they were in the six-side ring shape. At that time they were working in the traditional ring, but for this show they had the six-side ring again. So it changed the dynamic a little bit, and it was a callback to the old days. But it was very very different from what they were doing before. Plus in this match, Chris Daniels for once was pretty much straight babyface. And speaking about the Destination X 2011 match, which was pretty much a rarity because mostly he was always heelish or total heel. So pretty much. I don't see what I can add to what you already said because you went in a lot of detail. Yeah, awesome match. It's very very different from the another one we haven't talked about yet, which is the 2009 match.
We haven't talked about the 2009 match, and do you have the 2005 match? Not to spoil the list, but...
Yeah. I'm thinking the last one at this point was 2009, and it's very different from this one, to me, at least.
I agree.
And it was amazing to see. And that's why when I was going back and rewatching all those matches, it struck me as it's basically the Misawa Kawada feud of TNA, because... they were having very different match every time around, except for the very last, which was the
to be honest with you, Misawa Kawada did do that too, because if you think about it, in 2000, I don't know if you've seen the 2005 Noah match that Misawa Kawada had.
Yes.
That's their greatest hits match. And that was their final match together.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I think this analogy really works, and in some respect, and as far the so the other one is number 21 on my list, actually, the last man standing.
Yep.
And again, I agree, great match and totally different, total brawl, very basic. And again, Christopher Daniels have been accused before of being too smooth, but what I'm saying, I never understood that about Chris Daniels, because I'm watching his match, it's not smooth. I mean, he's very vicious in this match. He is very vicious
in this match. I agree with you. Yep.
It looks really crisp. I mean, when he punches, he's got great punch, and he's got like heel mannerism and stuff. So there's blood. I don't have this match. I should have this match a little bit higher on my list, because I really love the first part of the match, the brawling part, really great stuff. I don't have this match higher than I have for one reason. Basically, like you said, another thing. One thing I really enjoy is that they don't overdo the last man standing gimmick, because again, that's a gimmick. Usually, I'm going down for a spot that I wouldn't do, in a normal match, but since it's last man standing, I have to go down and be counted, and it's quite repetitive and tedious to me.
Yeah, especially when you start getting to 8 and 9, you just have these long lulls where you have to wait for the count. Yeah,
exactly.
It kills the momentum, yeah.
Totally. Kills the flow of the match. And they didn't do that at all. It's really a brawl, and at some point you have to work. So I'm coming back to my earlier point. I don't have this match higher on my list, although I really love it. For one reason, basically, it's that it's basically the exact same structure as the Bully Ray AJ Styles match, Last Man Standing, is that we have a brawling sequence inside the ring, which is great. And then the match goes outside on the ramp, and you have the big spot at the end. In this case, it was what? AJ Styles hitting whatever.
Styles Clash, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you have the big spot off the ramp on the table, which is a great spot, by the way. But to me, it was too close to the Bully Ray AJ Styles structure. It was basically the same thing.
It is a very similar match. Exactly. I happen to like both matches.
I've seen that before. it's like, yeah, they're kind of doing the same thing. So it's just a little bit of criticism for me. But anyway, it's still an awesome match. But maybe if I have not seen if they have not done the Bully Ray AJ Styles match the year prior, probably I would have this match higher because I really love it.
Yeah, that's fair.
A very small criticism.
Yeah.
It's nitpicking at this point.
And that's a wrap for Pro Wrestling Love Volume 3. Hope you enjoyed the podcast as we covered number 15 through 11. Next week we will enter the top 10 for the greatest Impact Wrestling / TNA Wrestling greatest matches of all time. For me and Jerome, hope you enjoyed this podcast. Hope you're looking forward to next week's podcast, and have a great day, everyone.